This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld. Der Handel an den Finanzmärkten kann eine einsame Angelegenheit sein. Wenn Sie also wissen möchten, wie man den Dunkelmodus auf Ihrer Plattform aktiviert oder wie Sie auf Ihr Konto einzahlen können, dann ist es gut, wenn Sie mit einem echten Menschen sprechen. Bei Kapital.com sprechen unsere Teams Deutsch, Französisch, Italienisch, Spanisch und viele andere Sprachen. Setzen Sie sich mit uns in Verbindung und wir helfen Ihnen gerne bei der Beantwortung Ihrer Fragen zum Thema Trading. Kapital.com. Entdecken Sie einen Broker, der Ihre Sprache spricht. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm Krupa Bhatia and it's good to have you with us. European leaders have met in Paris for impromptu talks on the future of Ukraine. It is a hastily convened summit off the back of not being invited by the US to peace talks with Russia, which are taking place in Saudi Arabia. The challenge is to put on a united front on security spending and convince the US that Europe is an invaluable partner at that negotiating table between Russia and Ukraine if a ceasefire deal is to be reached. Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer described it as a once-in-a-generation imperative. He said he was ready to consider committing British troops as part of an eventual peace deal, but said a US backstop on security was essential to stop further Russian aggression.
I'm prepared to consider committing British forces on the ground alongside others if there is a lasting peace agreement. But there must be a US backstop, because a US security guarantee is the only way to effectively deter Russia from attacking Ukraine again.
The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has also been speaking to the media and has said that Ukraine was not bound to accept the result of any US-Russian talks. He admitted to being irritated by what he called premature debates over Ukraine's future that it wasn't even party to. Meanwhile, ahead of that first face-to-face meeting taking place tomorrow with the new US administration in Riyadh, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov insisted that Europe had no role at the negotiating table, suggesting Europe wants the war to continue.
I don't know what they would be doing at the negotiating table. If they're going to concoct some cunning ideas about freezing the conflict, while really they mean continuing the war, then why invite them there?
Let's hear now from our correspondent, Andrew Harding. He's watching events in Paris where that meeting of European leaders has taken place. I asked him what message the talks are sending.
Well, unity is certainly one message that I think all of those who came to Paris want to emphasize. There is a political point to be made with this emergency summit or meeting, and that is to push back against some of the rhetoric, anti-Western, frankly, anti-European rhetoric that countries on this continent have heard with some shock coming from the White House, from President Trump's closest aides and officials in the past few days. And I think Europe is keen to stress that there can be no peace process for Ukraine without Europe and without Ukraine's involvement. Now, we've also heard today plenty of criticism from the Russians and the Americans, sounding curiously similar in many ways, dismissing European concerns and belittling them in some ways, saying that there is nothing to worry about, that, you know, a deal will be done and, you know, Ukraine will need to buy into that at some point. But clearly, big picture wise, Europe is worried that it is being sidelined, that its strategic, long-term strategic concerns are being pushed to one side. On more practical, shorter term issues, clearly the Europeans are looking to the possibility of a ceasefire deal, the possibility of a pause at least in the fighting, and the prospect that they may be asked to supply troops to help with peacekeeping operations along Ukraine's very long front line with Russia. We already heard Keir Starmer offering British forces, potentially. The Swedish have also said much the same. Other nations are being much more cautious, partly, I suspect, for domestic political reasons. Also, perhaps because they want to stress to Donald Trump that if he wants to make a deal, he needs Europe's buy-in, and that he can't simply assume that there will be European troops available to police that.
Andrew Harding for us in Paris there. It is just a week, of course, since President Putin and President Trump spoke on the phone, and now all eyes are on Riyadh as those two leaders get ready to meet tomorrow. It will be the most significant contact between Moscow and Washington since the start of the war in Ukraine. Dmitry Trenin is a Russian foreign policy expert and a former military intelligence officer. This is his take on how things are being viewed from Russia.
I think the question that is on many people in Moscow's minds is whether the United States is serious about ending the war, not just imposing a ceasefire. At least initially, statements by President Trump led us to believe that he was primarily interested in stopping the fighting rather than ending the war. You end the war when you do away with the causes of that war, when you bring peace that can last. Many people believe that for the United States, and in fact for some other people in the West, what mattered would be just to freeze the conflict. Ukraine is losing, Russia is winning, so it's time to stop the Russian forces in their tracks. And this is not what the Russians want. They want a number of things that I think we have heard a lot about. One is stopping the very idea of NATO's further enlargement. We also heard from Putin that the goals of the Russian military operation in Ukraine had much to do with the nature of the Ukrainian regime. We also heard about neutral status for Ukraine, demilitarized status for Ukraine. So it's a fairly long list.
It is a long list. And I wonder whether you believe that long list can be achieved without Ukraine at the negotiating table.
Well, with Ukraine as it is now at the negotiating table, nothing can be achieved. Ukraine, as you know, Vladimir Zelensky signed a decree basically banning all negotiations with Russia. Ukraine had a chance in 22 to get an agreement with Russia that was, from the standpoint of today, extremely generous. Ukraine had a very good opportunity as a result of the Minsk Accords of 2015 to reintegrate Donbass into Ukraine on conditions of wide autonomy. And Ukraine essentially did not fulfill its obligations under that agreement.
We did hear from the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, who said that the talks would focus primarily on restoring the whole spectrum of Russia-US relations. What does that look like to you?
I think that when President Trump posted his first statement on Russia, it looked like, you know, a traditional, typical, pretty unconstructive, pretty arrogant statement to the Russians. Putin is destroying the country. I will do you a favor, very condescending and, as I said, arrogant statement. And something changed. After a few days, the two presidents had a phone call, and then came Trump's next public statement on Russia, which was absolutely different in both style and substance. And then, of course, came Munich. We need to understand, I think, in Russia, how serious the change is on foreign policy issues in the White House. What is Trump up to? What is his actual worldview? What are his intentions? And maybe the meetings in Riyadh will provide some of the answers.
Whilst the meeting in Riyadh is taking place, we've also had this emergency summit in Paris attended by European leaders. How is that being seen by Moscow?
It's seen mostly as a comment by the people who, in this situation, cannot do much other than get together and decide how they deal with the very previously unlikely and seemingly dangerous for them rapprochement between the United States and Russia. It's a meeting of losers, losers that can come up, can present problems, because they, some of them may feel desperate, some of them may feel they can provoke the United States into changing its policy line. So I think that there's certainly some amount of interest in what Europe is up to, but maybe not so much in terms of diplomatic engagements in Paris, but what material provocations the Europeans can mount in order to wreck the train of potential, again, U.S.-Russian rapprochement.
The views there of the Russian foreign policy expert Dmitry Trenin. Meanwhile, here in the UK, Prime Minister Keir Starmer has said he is ready to put UK peacekeeping troops in Ukraine if and when the war ends. Tobias Elwood is a British former Member of Parliament, a former Defence Minister and former soldier. I asked him for his view on the concern from one former head of the British Army that the UK doesn't have the numbers to send a large force to Ukraine for an extended period.
I'm pleased to see Britain is willing to step forward, particularly when there's a void, when America steps back. But you're absolutely right, as your question implies. The state of our armed forces is already being tested. It's overstretched. Boots on the ground, whether it's the top cover by our RAF or the maritime component in the Black Sea, we're short on all three fronts. We send a symbolic gesture, I think, put something on the table to offer other countries to follow suit. But ultimately, we're seeing Europe become more dangerous, not less. And there'll be massive pressure now to increase the defense budgets. But it's the operational side. There's a bigger picture here. You introduced this by saying all eyes on Riyadh. But the future of Ukraine is being discussed there only by a US president who's happy to put down the terms of the deal, but wants little to do with its implementation. And the aggressor is also there, who can now claim a form of victory, able to rearm and regroup and do it all again. And this certainly is what appeasement looks like. And it's no wonder this is being compared to 1938. So when we're talking about upgrading Britain's defense posture, it isn't just to support Ukraine. It's a wider recognition that with America dialing back its security interests in Europe, Europe has now become ever more dangerous.
So when we hear the UK Prime Minister saying in the past few minutes that this is a once in a generation moment for the collective security of Europe, would you agree?
100%. I mean, I was at the Munich Security Conference, and I've never witnessed the atmosphere, a more somber atmosphere, as a clear void develops between Europe and America, not just how to support Ukraine, not just how to face up to Putin, but the very future of European security, with the US deciding to row back on its long-term security interests, with Trump looking at Europe now as a competitor to do deals with, perhaps, but ultimately to actually throw in spoilers. To hear Vance talk about an abortion clinic that happens to be in my district in the United Kingdom, or support the AFD, this is stirring up political discord within Europe. Who does that help? It only helps our competitors, our adversaries, or indeed America, if it's economically competing against Europe. And this, and the bigger picture, when you see Russia and China coming together and the demise of our global order, this isn't what Europe and America should be doing.
Tobias Elwood, a British former Member of Parliament, reacting to developments today in Paris, where European leaders have met for that emergency summit on the future of Ukraine. Coming up, we'll hear about life in Gaza from the point of view of a child.
My name is Abdullah. I'm 13 years old. I'm stuck here in Gaza.
Today I'm revisiting Khan Yunis camp. This area used to be colorful. Now it's gray, just gray.
I was in the best school in Gaza, the British school in the north. All my lessons were in English. Now I'm living in a tent.
That report coming up in 20 minutes' time. And our headlines this hour: European leaders have stressed the need to take responsibility for their own security after a meeting to discuss President Trump's move to negotiate directly with Russia over Ukraine. And an airliner has landed upside down at Toronto International Airport in Canada, but everyone aboard is said to be accounted for. This is Krupa Party with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. With less than a week to go until Germany's national election, migration has become the dominant topic. 10 years ago, at the height of Europe's migration crisis, the BBC visited Oberhausen in West Germany to find out how the area was coping. A decade on, we've gone back and attitudes have shifted, as our Berlin correspondent Jess Parker has found out.
I'm at the home of Alia and her 10-year-old son, Rami.
We'll take our shoes off. Thank you so much.
They live in a one-bed apartment in West Germany.
Oh, thanks God that we are in our home.
Alia's learned German and is grateful to her adopted country, but believes some migrants have integrated more than others.
For 10 years, it was very welcoming, but after more problems, the people said, oh, Ausländer raus.
Foreigners out.
Yes. That was really sad for me because we are not actually bad because we don't want to live in this situation also.
We just got into Oberhausen and it's a Saturday lunchtime and we stumbled into a demonstration pretty much on arrival. It's a demonstration against the far-right party Alternative für Deutschland.
I want that my country wants people to get here if they are in trouble.
Peers at the demo with friends and family. That's what you want to keep, yeah. a generous asylum, yeah, policy. Do you think that is where Germany is going to end up in the next few years?
I don't think so.
There is so much tension now around immigration. Yeah. Do you therefore think some mistakes have been made in the way successive governments have handled this issue?
Maybe yes. Maybe they didn't thought about the things enough. They said, yeah, we will do it.
We'll manage, we'll make it. Angela Merkel.
Yeah, she said it.
Some breaking news that's coming into us from Germany. A vehicle has been driven into a group of people in...
A string of fatal attacks involving suspects who've been asylum seekers has intensified Germany's fraught migration debate. 66-year-old Georg has lived in Oberhausen most of his life. I meet him strolling near the local park. Does he now want tougher border controls?
It's hard. There has to be security. Not like it is right now. It has to change.
A heated argument breaks out at a campaign stand for the AfD party. Between two men of colour and a local AfD activist, Jörg Langer.
We heard you tell him to go back to his own country.
Yeah.
I mean, he grew up, yeah, here. That is clear racism, no?
Nein, ist kein Rassismus.
No, that's not racism.
How is it not?
Er hat mich persönlich angegriffen.
I mean, he personally attacked me. He said, you're a Nazi. And then, of course, you have to say, if something doesn't suit you here in Germany, then you can go back.
I catch up with the two men involved in the argument, Kwame and Pratep.
He told us to go back.
Go back is like three streets away from here.
Like, where should us go? Where should we go back? We grew up over here. We've done everything. We have kids here.
In Germany, yes. Do you see the attitudes have changed?
Yeah.
The last 4 or 5 years, yeah.
It's okay.
Back at home with Alia and Rami, a boy who's the same age as Europe's migration crisis, he dreams of being a doctor, footballer, or policeman. As he decides his future, so does Germany.
Our Berlin correspondent, Jess Parker. Right, it might not seem like the most conventional way to counter the impacts of climate change, but we're going to talk more about why some scientists are suggesting the reintroduction of wolves to the Scottish Highlands might help hit net zero. Now, wolves were hunted to extinction in Britain more than 2 centuries ago. They're often feared creatures by animals and by humans. So talk about reintroducing about 160 of them, as is suggested by this study, might be hard for some to get their heads around.
Professor Dominic Spracklin was lead author of the paper from the University of Leeds. I asked him why he thinks this is a good idea.
Well, so in the UK, deer no longer have a natural predator at all. We don't have wolves, we don't have lynx anymore. And that means that deer populations have been steadily increasing over the years. In Scotland, there's now over 500,000 red deer across the Scottish Highlands. And that's too many deer for many of our woodlands. Our woodlands are not regenerating. Those deer are eating all of the tree saplings before they can grow. So our woodlands are quite unhealthy. They're not regenerating and they're not able to expand. And that has big negative impacts for biodiversity and also has negative impacts for climate. And so our work really was trying to show one possible ecological benefit of reintroducing wolves, that through doing that, they would restore some balance in the system. They would help balance those red deer numbers through preying on the red deer and bring those populations down enough to allow woodlands to start to regenerate naturally again and be able to expand again. And obviously those expanding woodlands would start to store carbon, and that's how they could help address the climate emergency.
This was tried, I believe, back in 1995 at the Yellowstone National Park in the US when wolves were introduced. It seemed to work initially to restore and expand wildlife, but later, decades on, it saw damage from those herds grazing and trampling, and the feelings were that wolves were not a magic bullet when it comes to correcting the ecosystem. There will be farmers and members of the rural community quite worried by this idea.
So I think wolves are definitely not a magic bullet, but I think, you know, they can have this really strong ecological benefit. They're ecosystem engineers, and in the Yellowstone National Park, new evidence has emerged, just really showing how large that benefit is in terms of allowing those riparian woodlands to expand as the wolves have controlled the populations of deer in Yellowstone National Park. So real evidence from there demonstrating that it works. I think your point about farmers is very valid. We weren't trying to underplay the potential challenges that a wolf reintroduction would have in Scotland or in the UK. Wolves would undoubtedly prey on sheep, and that is a major challenge, and we weren't trying to underplay that.
Mm. Increasing predators are being seen as a key part of the EU's biodiversity strategy. They say that their presence ensures the health of the whole food chain. Is this something we're going to see more of?
I think, you know, we're facing major crises in biodiversity and climate change. I think we need to start to think more widely, more broadly, and think about, you know, the ways trying to restore healthy ecosystems, restore some of the lost species back into those ecosystems could help us address some of those really large challenges. In Europe, wolves have started to recolonize large parts of their former range. They're now in Germany. They're now in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands is, you know, really densely populated with humans. And wolves are living there quite close to humans within, you know, densely populated areas, showing that coexistence is possible. There are challenges across Europe with livestock farmers. But in some areas, farmers are learning again how to live with wolves back in the landscape. And there's some inspiring stories about farmers finding old methods, I guess, of how they did that in the past and using them again.
Dominic Spracklin there, lead author of that paper from the University of Leeds on reintroducing wolves to the Scottish Highlands and how it could lead to an expansion of native woodlands. That is their aim. And the hope is that move would take in and store about 1 million tonnes of CO2 annually. For a bit of context, that is the equivalent to approximately 5% of the carbon removal target for UK woodlands. There's more News Hour coming up after a quick news bulletin.
The Handel an den Finanzmärkten kann eine einsame Angelegenheit sein. Wenn Sie also wissen möchten, wie man den Dunkelmodus auf Ihrer Plattform aktiviert oder wie Sie auf Ihr Konto einzahlen können, dann ist es gut, wenn Sie mit einem echten Menschen sprechen. Bei Kapital.com sprechen unsere Teams Deutsch, Französisch, Italienisch, Spanisch und viele andere Sprachen. Setzen Sie sich mit uns in Verbindung und wir helfen Ihnen gerne bei der Beantwortung Ihrer Fragen zum Thema Trading. Kapital.com. Entdecken Sie einen Broker, der Ihre Sprache spricht. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello, this is Valerie Sanderson from the Global News Podcast. We're bringing you the latest on talks in Paris to discuss European security and an end to fighting in Ukraine. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It is one of the most secret meetings on earth when cardinals gather behind very closed doors at the Vatican to elect a new pope. And last night in London, a movie called Conclave won 4 awards at the BAFTAs, including Best Film.
We're about to choose the most famous man in the world.
And 1.25 billion souls watching.
I'd say this is a pretty fair vision of hell.
Well, don't be blasphemous, Ray. Hell arrives tomorrow when we bring in the cardinals.
The film was based on a novel by Robert Harris, and he's been speaking about how it came to be with the BBC's Simon Jack.
I was writing another book at the time when the present Pope was elected, and you appear on the balcony to reveal who the new Pope is to the world, and the windows just before the appearance on the balcony fill with the faces of the cardinal electors. Mm. And I saw all these crafty, sly, elderly, benign faces, and I thought, my God, look, that's the Roman Senate. That's what it would have looked like. And then I thought, there must be some politics behind this. So I started researching it, and sure enough, there was. That election in particular was the model for the one in the novel and the film.
OK, so this was actually based on tidbits and stuff, yeah, of research you've done. So there is that kind of intrigue and backstabbing that goes on.
Yes, politics is my great interest. Mm. And there was a wonderful book published in the 50s called The Masters by C.P. Snow. And it was all about the election of a master in a Cambridge college in the 1930s. And I thought that whole power dynamic of colleagues who know one another in a sort of enclosed institution, how it would work, how it would play out. Was this a way of universalising politics in a way? That's what drew me to it. And then there's the marvellous ritual of the church and the fact that this is an election for God's representative on earth.
Yep. Only makes stakes are high.
Yeah, and the great thing for any dramatist or novelist is if all the dialogue, nobody's ever saying quite what they mean. Right. It's all sort of slightly aimed off. So everyone has to say they have no personal ambition. Obviously, they hope the chalice passes, mm-hmm, to someone else. And, you know, the Sistine Chapel was built for the election of a pope. I mean, that's what it's there for. And it's the way that they're locked in. So you've also got a slight Agatha Christie locked room dynamic.
Given the fact you've had a few turned into films, do you actually now start writing the book where you think, oh, this would make a great scene, I can imagine this on the big screen?
No, I don't. I think that would be fatal. And actually, it's a pretty long shot that anyone would ever have made Conclave, if you think about it. It's 118 elderly men. I mean, one thing it definitely wasn't up for last night was Best Actress, because there's only a small supporting part. It's pretty diverse. Everyone's from all over the world. But
the voting process is quite tedious by modern standards.
Yes, but this is great, you see. There's a vote and then it resets. And everyone thinks, oh, that's boring, isn't it? But it's not. There's a dramatic device. They all come back and do it again. And now a front runner is being squeezed out. Because the moment you get a front runner, everyone, of course, wants to pull them down or block them.
Robert Harris in conversation with the BBC's Simon Jack. It is something we have shared many times over the last 16 months. We, along with other international media, have not been allowed access to Gaza, other than occasionally under very limited conditions with the Israeli army. And so it's always a challenge to try to get a sense of what living in that embattled, devastated enclave is like. To that end, a new BBC documentary has spent the last 9 months following the lives of 4 young people in Gaza as they try to survive the Israel-Hamas war and as they hope for a lasting ceasefire.
The filmmakers remotely directed two cameramen on the ground to tell the children's stories. In this piece you're about to hear, we meet Renard, a 10-year-old food blogger who dreams of being a chef, and the film's narrator, Abdullah.
My name is Abdullah. I'm 13 years old. I'm stuck here in Gaza.
Today I'm revisiting Khan Yunis camp. This area used to be colorful. Now it's grey, just grey.
Among the rubble, I find what's left of my grandfather's house.
What?
Everything's changed since the war started. I was in the best school in Gaza, the British school in the north. All my lessons were in English. Now I'm living in a tent. On my way back, I find a crowd of people fleeing the eastern areas of Khan Yunis. When the Israeli army call an evacuation order, we have to leave fast, or it can be deadly.
They have killed our children, killed our women, while Sinwar is hiding underground. Hamas is shooting back.
You have to find something to distract you from the constant pressure of this war.
During the war, there's no school, no place for us to play, so I upload videos and talk to my followers.
Renat's 10. She started an online cooking show with her sister. They're lucky enough to still live in their own home and film her videos on the roof. While they film, there's an interruption as bombs fall nearby.
We're not afraid anymore. We're used to it. Even in the middle of the night, I'm not scared.
My family moved south to be in the safe zone. But last night, close to my place, the Israeli army hit the camp with huge bombs. 19 people were killed. I've come to see the damage.
This camp was filled with tents. They got buried underground. Oh my God.
How many missiles did they fire? Four? No, it was six. They said there was a secret room for Hamas. We live here. There are no Hamas leaders in this area. Even for one or two, is it right to kill so many people?
Every day there are more evacuation orders. We mainly get these by phone, texts, and social media.
Urgent message. You are required to evacuate the designated humanitarian zone. The Israel Defense Forces will be conducting full-scale operations against terrorist organizations.
Renat's family are preparing in case they need to leave fast.
In the end, Renat was able to stay in her house. And now she has reached 1 million followers. But bombs are still dropping in the safe zone.
We were just sitting here when a bombing suddenly went off. The blast was so loud and there's gunfire too. We were all so frightened right now.
The war seems like it's been going on forever. Then there's an announcement. Renat's gone to watch at a cafe with her brother.
Now I have hope.
The ceasefire is starting.
People are going to see what's left of their homes.
My house was completely destroyed, so my family have found an apartment. It's damaged, but it's better than the tents. And I just turned 14.
I got old. I'm getting old, actually. My mustache is growing.
My greatest hope is that the ceasefire continues and Gaza goes back to what it was before, or even better. But my biggest fear is that the war will return.
Gazan teenager Abdallah sharing his thoughts. That piece is part of this new BBC documentary, Gaza, How to Survive a War Zone. Well, we're going to stay with Gaza for a short time now. We've spoken about that meeting due to take place between the US and Russian officials in Saudi Arabia tomorrow. In addition to Ukraine, also high on their agenda of that meeting is going to be Gaza, with concerns from those looking in that key voices are being left out of important conversations. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that he was cooperating with the US on a common strategy for the Palestinian territory after a meeting with the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Jerusalem yesterday. And that visit comes amid much uncertainty about the future of that ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. So how is this all being seen by the Saudis who are hosting the talks? Faisal Abbas is the editor-in-chief of the Riyadh-based English-language daily Arab News. I asked him about Saudi Arabia's negotiating tactics. The kingdom has said that it would not accept an ethnic cleansing of Gaza, but that it is entering talks with the US Secretary of State. So what message does Faisal think Mohammed bin Salman is trying to send?
The mere fact that a very strongly worded statement came out less than 20 minutes after the Benjamin Netanyahu-Trump press conference, which would have been around 5 a.m. Saudi time, refusing any notion of displacement of Palestinians, sends a clear message that this is not something Saudi Arabia is even willing to consider. After that, of course, the King of Jordan went to visit Trump and did respond, saying that there is going to be Arab consultations led by Saudi Arabia and that there will be an Arab counter proposal. So I think definitely that discussion is going to be on the table, or at least hints of it, until a fully-fledged Arab counter proposal comes out, which would be a bit more realistic than what has been suggested about displacing around 2 million people.
Do you believe the future of Gaza and the solution, whatever that may look like, needs to be Arab-led?
Definitely. We've seen what the alternative is. So the alternative is not even, it's not even a point to start the discussion. So it has to be Arab-led. And in a way, the Arab League, Saudi Arabia, countries that are surrounding Gaza are taking charge. So I think you will hear from the Arab League. There are consultations that are about to happen in Saudi Arabia, involving a number of concerned countries such as Jordan and Egypt, as well as a number of other Gulf states. And there will be a counter proposal. Now, whether or not the other side, i.e. the Israelis, accept to it is a different story.
Within this, what is the role that Saudi Arabia is seeking for itself when it comes to the Palestinian cause and the future of Gaza?
It's not about a role, but about leverage. What Saudi Arabia brings, perhaps compared to other countries who have signed Abraham Accords or have signed normalization deals with Israel, is Saudi Arabia is in a league of its own, given the religious, given the political and the economic clout and leadership, the position that it has in the Arab and Muslim world. So what it brings is not a role, but more of leverage, because with Saudi Arabia comes a stamp of approval from the custodian of the two holy mosques, and that will be a sign for the rest of the Muslim and Arab world. The price has always been a recognition of or a road to a Palestinian state, or a Palestinian state, or at least a recognition of the rights of Palestinians to have their own state.
You mentioned normalization there. Specifically, what are the red lines that you believe need to be respected for the kingdom to resume any normalization talks with Israel?
The kingdom has made it very clear over and over again that without a recognition of the Palestinian state, the conversation cannot be happening. So this is why the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has not joined the Abraham Accords. This is why we've been trying for the past 2 years in efforts spearheaded by the foreign minister to form a global coalition for the two-state solution, because that, we believe, that is the only way to guarantee Israel's security needs and also give Palestinians what they rightly deserve, which is a state of their own.
Of course, it's not solely about the Palestinian cause now. Since this conflict began, we've seen an increased presence of Israel in South Lebanon, in the Syrian Golan Heights. How far does the message you highlight there extend?
Well, it's different scenarios. And so in Lebanon, the Shibha Farms, for example, is disputed whether it's Lebanese or Syrian territory. And there's a clear UN resolution about Israel having to withdraw from Lebanese territories. The new transitional Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, has said in the get-go that the country is in no mood to start any wars. They cannot take on any wars. At the same time, has called for Israel to leave any occupied territories that they have. But essentially, they're sending the right message.
Moving on to those talks on the future of Ukraine between Russia and the US, also taking place in Saudi Arabia. What role does the kingdom envision playing there? And what is it going to be pushing for?
From the get-go, despite Saudi Arabia condemning the Russian aggression against Ukraine and voting against Russia in the United Nations, Riyadh has positioned itself as a possible mediator or facilitator for peace talks. And not just offering itself, but it actually has proven that given the relationship and trust that it enjoys in Moscow and in Kiev and in Washington, it successfully managed to broker or guarantee the success of two prisoner swap deals. So the stars are aligned, actually, for the kingdom to be neutral grounds for such talks between, first of all, the U.S. and Russia, and then hopefully Russia and Ukraine. In fact, the Ukrainian president is on his way to Saudi Arabia. President Zelensky will be there tomorrow for talks. I'm guessing the meeting between Trump and Putin is to agree on a number of things or to discuss a number of things, including the Ukrainian affair. But there is no attempt whatsoever to exclude the Ukrainians from a Russian-Ukrainian negotiation. In fact, that's why the talks held in Switzerland were not fruitful. You cannot have a peace conference or discussions without both sides being at the table.
Faisal Abbas, editor-in-chief of the Riyadh-based English language daily Arab News. And let me also point you in the direction of an interesting piece written up by my colleague Sebastian Usher, who's our Middle East analyst currently in Jerusalem. He's writing about the choice by the Trump administration of Saudi Arabia as the location for those key talks on Ukraine and Gaza and what this signifies about Saudi's role in the world. Do have a read if you can. This is Krupa Party, live with NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Now, if you struggle in bustling, noisy environments and you'd rather help your brain focus just on one sound at a time, then you might be a big fan of noise-cancelling headphones. But questions are being raised over whether the use of them is actually altering the way our brain processes and distinguishes sound, leading to users struggling in normal everyday situations. For Sophie, she realised something wasn't quite right when she found it hard to understand her classes at university.
The lecturer would be speaking into a mic which would be put in speakers all around the hall. It just sounded like jumble. I couldn't really work out a lot of the sentences. It can be quite overstimulating when I'm in really, really busy, loud environments where there's lots of noises going on. I just don't really often know what people are saying around me. I have to really, really hyper focus in those environments.
I have to say, like Sophie there, it did take me quite a bit of time to get used to noise-cancelling headphones. I often felt like I was underwater. Well, Claire Benton is the president of the British Academy of Audiology. She explained to the BBC's Sarah Montague what could be causing these types of problems.
What tends to happen with the noise cancellation is you're kind of getting rid of your natural soundscape. So your brain is not having to discriminate speech or whatever you're listening to in background noise. And that's quite a high level processing skill that you need to kind of exercise to still be able to use. So you're almost creating this false environment to listen in. So when you go out somewhere noisy, you're going to your restaurant and there's someone sat opposite you talking to you, you're really struggling to listen to them and pick their noise out from the general conversational babble or noise of cutlery and people moving around. So we're getting more younger people thinking they've got hearing loss, going to see an audiologist to have a hearing test, and your standard hearing test doesn't show processing ability. So they're coming out with normal hearing, but still struggle in like the real world.
Right. So you've retrained your brain not to be able to cope with a normal soundscape.
Yeah, it's a bit like you stop going to the gym, your muscles start to go. It's the same with your brain processing skills.
Mm-hmm.
There are things you can do to, and there's apps out there that you can do to exercise your processing skills that seem to be getting really good results as well. So just naturally out and about in background noise. We also think it's partly because a lot more people are working from home. So you're doing things by teams, you're doing things by yourself and not really experiencing a normal listening environment.
Audiologist Claire Bentham. Now, she's been called the Queen of the People, Mexican singer Paquita La del Barrio, who became a feminist icon in Latin American music for her songs that spoke to the experiences of women in the region, has died at the age of 77. She sold more than 20 million records in her career, and in 2017, her life was dramatized in a TV series. From Mexico City, I've been speaking to the actor, comedian and writer Andrea Ortega Lee, who played Paquita in the show. I asked her to tell us a bit more about her life and how that informed the musician she came to be.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes, it's a very sad loss for Mexico and the world and the world of music in general. And yes, she had a very difficult childhood. She had a very difficult life in general. She was born into poverty in an isolated community far from Mexico City, and yet she was able to break through into Mexico's entertainment business, which is localized in Mexico City and was not at the time very generous to either women and even less women who were not conventionally attractive. And her music proposal was very, very new and very different at the time. And even though she sang rancheras, the topics and the way that she spoke and managed herself on stage was very, very new for the times.
It sounds like her music almost became a safe space for women. Explain to us how her relationships with the men in her life informed her style of music.
Yes, she was a victim of various forms of abuse. She was married very, very young to a man who turned out to be already married, who was a bigamist. And then she had children. She lost children. And then she remarried and she suffered from infidelity and all sorts of other machista abuses from not only her husbands, but other men in her life. And that made her informed the way that she sang about men and relationships, always in a very humorous and satirical way, where, yes, she created a safe space for every woman who listens to her songs that can identify with not only heartbreak, but with being a victim of machista violence or abuse of sorts. And what happens is every time a Paquita song plays in a public place, what happens is a sense of community and catharsis amongst women, where we are telling each other, "I know what you've been through, sister, and let's laugh at the men who have tortured us and that have been violent towards us at any level or form."
I understand she went on to inspire a whole new style, a whole new genre of music in Mexico.
Yes, it's a genre of sorts. We call it the ardidas, the música de ardidas, and it's where all heartbroken women can sing from the bottom of their hearts this very very intense feelings of pain, but also desires for retribution and laughter and just mockery of the man who has your heart. And yes, a whole generations of new singers have been inspired by this sort of narrative in music.
Actor, comedian and writer Andrea Ortega Lee, ending this hour of NewsHour. Thank you for your company and do stay with the BBC World Service.
Hello, this is Valerie Sanderson from the Global News Podcast. We're bringing you the latest on talks in Paris to discuss European security and an end to fighting in Ukraine. Join us to hear the day's top stories from BBC News, delivered twice a day on weekdays, daily at weekends. Search for the Global News Podcast wherever you get your BBC podcasts.